This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. H. Ramakrishnan contracted polio as a toddler, and his mother carried him for the next 10 years. Yet he had the mental strength to go on to a career and family.
The whole problem is the society around you should encourage him or her to use that mental strength to come up in life.
A talk with Ramakrishnan about polio damage. Plus, Illinois Attorney General candidate Kwame Raoul is campaigning hard against his opponent, Erica Harold. GLT's Eric Stock caught up with Raoul in Bloomington. And Prairie Fire Theater rolls out its production of The Secret Garden. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Democratic candidate for Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul believes his background as a prosecutor and time as a state senator will help him root out corruption and protect consumers at what he considers to be a critical time in American history. Raoul was in Bloomington Normal over the weekend and spoke with GLT's Eric Stock.
Yeah, I've been practicing law for 25 years. I became a lawyer to be an advocate. And I think right now, at this moment in American history, attorney generals, not only in the state of Illinois, serve a more important role than they ever had in any time in American history. Part of that is as a result of the leadership or lack thereof that we're seeing from Washington. Attorney generals individually and collectively have taken action to protect citizens of the states. And I'd like to engage in that and continue engaging in that because I've been active as a policymaker for the last 14 years doing just that, whether it's protecting voting rights, protecting access to health care, and like to continue that because as Attorney General, the role is elevated more now than any time in American history.
A couple of the issues that you've been involved with involving higher education, which we can get to, and also fair elections. The governor had recently vetoed legislation to end the cross-check voter registration system. You believe that was politically motivated?
I really do. I mean, at a time, it's ironic that he vetoed the legislation just days after the revelation that Russian hackers probably hacked the Illinois State Board of Elections system. The Illinois State Board of Elections, we contacted them prior to me filing legislation asking whether they can check with CrossCheck to make sure that our voters' information is secure. And they replied that CrossCheck couldn't guarantee that the information was secure. That's why I filed legislation. That's why we passed the legislation. And I think it's just outrageous that the governor, just a few days after the revelation, the indictment of Russian hackers hacking into our state board of elections, that the governor would take that action to put voters' information at risk.
What is a better way to go, a safer way to go to ensure voter integrity?
We have the ERIC system that has been demonstrated as a safer system. It's a system that's even being embraced by the state of Missouri. So it's being embraced by neighboring states. So I don't have a problem with having a system, and I don't have a problem with communicating across state boundaries as long as the privacy of our voters is protected.
You've referenced higher education as a priority of yours in the state Senate for some 14 years now. And as you seek the attorney general position in Illinois, what role can the AG's office play in helping advance higher education in the state?
Well, there's one thing. You know, come this fall, I will have two kids attending college. and as my youngest is a girl, a young woman. She's just recently turned 18. And as I think about sending her off to college, one of the things I want to make sure is that she's protected from potential sexual assault on campus. And we've seen where Betsy DeVos has taken a step back in terms of the protections offered by the Federal Department of Education to protect against sexual assault on campus. Well, one of the things is Lisa Madigan stepped up where Betsy DeVos stepped back and made sure we passed a law here within the state of Illinois to make sure every higher education institution has policies to protect against that. The other thing is that as I think about sending my kids to college, I think about having to pay for it and having to incur debt, and my kids potentially having to incur debt, and their students being victimized throughout this country and certainly in the state of Illinois as well. By higher education institution, primarily for-profit, but some non-for-profit institutions that are sending kids into debt that they'll never get out of. And again, where the Federal Department of Education is stepping back, it's going to be incumbent upon the state attorney general's office to make sure that we hold those institutions accountable.
You had referenced Lisa Madigan, who, of course, is the attorney general now, has been for 16 years. She chose not to run for a fifth term, but seems to have had fairly widespread popularity. Do you see your candidacy as a continuation of her time in office, or do you plan to take the office in a different direction?
I wouldn't say taking it necessarily in a different direction. At the same time, I don't say that I'm a cookie-cutter duplicate of Lisa Madigan. She's done some great things protecting victims of sexual assault and domestic violence, advocating against consumer fraud and protecting the environment. And, you know, just recently she stepped up where Jeff Sessions stepped back with regards to making sure the City of Chicago Police Department is party to a consent decree. So we don't repeat law enforcement abuses of the past. So certainly on those fronts, I would continue the work of Lisa Madigan. But there's some things I would do in addition to that. I've been an advocate for criminal justice reform. I think when we try to promote safe communities, criminal justice reform is one of the areas that we need to lend voice to. And the Attorney General's office has a bully pulpit. And I intend on using that bully pulpit to promote criminal justice reform. When Governor Rauner came in, I spoke to him. I penned an op-ed along with Governor Rauner and tried to work on a bipartisan effort with his now chief of staff on the Criminal Justice Reform and Sentencing Commission. I think it's an important role for an attorney general to have voice in, and I intend on having a voice in that more aggressively than Lisa Madigan has. The other thing is I created the public access counselor within the attorney general's office. That public access counselor's office is a good office to have, but to the extent that it's under-resourced and overburdened, it doesn't serve in the role that it was meant to serve. And so I intend on turning some attention to that because I think the best disinfectant to public corruption is transparency. And I intend on making sure that we create that transparency in the state of Illinois.
And I think it might be fair to say one of the public criticisms that Attorney General Madigan has fielded was that her office did not go after public corruption to the extent that some of her critics thought. The Chicago Tribune a year ago said that she had been, quote, glued to the sidelines on this issue. Do you feel that she could have done more, and how do you take the office to go more after public corruption at a time where, as you said at the beginning, it is a very much concern at the state and national level in this country?
Right. Again, as Justice Brandeis once said, the best disinfectant to public corruption is sunshine. And I think that you won't have public officials and people serving in a public way do things if there are eyes watching them. And I think the Attorney General's office plays a critical role there with regards to the public access counselor. But in addition to that, there is a public integrity unit within the Attorney General's office that can effectively investigate allegations of public corruption that are brought before them. And Attorney General's office can also collaborate with both federal prosecutors as well as local prosecutors to pursue public corruption.
Do you plan to make that a greater focus in your, if you are elected?
I plan on investigating any allegation of public corruption, credible allegation of public corruption brought to my attention.
As we continue here on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stonck, joined by Kwame Raoul, who is a candidate for Illinois Attorney General, an issue that came up earlier in the campaign that your opponent, Erica Harold, had seemed to show some interest in and maybe backed off just a bit, was the idea of calling for a statewide grand jury to prosecute cases, perhaps to have a greater likelihood of getting a conviction in a case. What do you think about that? Is that something that you might consider?
It's an issue worthy of debate and consideration, for certain. It's a question of volume. You know, we have a general conversation about public corruption, but nobody talks very specific about what that volume is and whether it's something that cannot be handled with the powers that exist right now. Like I said earlier, there is a public integrity unit. There is capacity to collaborate both with local prosecutors as well as federal prosecutors. One of the things you have to consider is in this state, that is an under-resourced state, if you're going to give the attorney general these grand jury powers, you better appropriately resource them to effectively do the job there as well.
Attorney General Madigan has become pretty heavily involved in the immigration battle. She had contested the U.S. Department of Justice's withholding of millions of dollars from the state because it argues the state's sanctuary law violates federal immigration policy. Has she taken the right steps on this issue? Would you go further?
I think she has taken the right steps. And, you know, I'm a child of immigrants that made a tremendous contribution to this country. My father served as a community physician for 30 years, and he and my mother came to this country in the 1950s. They're naturalized citizens, and they made tremendous contributions to this country, as immigrants have done for centuries. We're a nation of immigrants, and our state, on a bipartisan basis, has embraced policies that it would be my job as Attorney General to enforce. And Lisa Madigan has taken that step, and I would continue that.
And you wonder what could be done at the federal level. The president has been given, and this was upheld just a couple of weeks ago, a very broad power when it comes to creating and enforcing immigration policy as a national security issue. So what really can you do?
Well, again, we can make sure that our state resources, our state law enforcement resources are used to enforce state law, and it is the state law that state law enforcement resources are not utilized to enforce the immigration policies coming from the federal government. We have autonomy as a state of Illinois, and there is a 10th Amendment, and it is my job as the Attorney General, it will be my job as the Attorney General to enforce the state laws that the legislature enacted and the governor signed.
But how then do you get the money that the federal government's withholding?
Well, as the city of Chicago has just done, where Jeff Sessions tried to withhold money, city of Chicago went to federal court and obtained a restraining order on Jeff Sessions. As Attorney General, if there was an effort to do the same to the state of Illinois, I would take the same action. It would be my responsibility to do so. It would be my responsibility to enforce the law and make sure I protect the citizens of the state of Illinois and make sure we get the resources that are due to the state of Illinois.
President Trump's choice to fill the Supreme Court vacancy, Brett Kavanaugh, has upset many liberals and in particular pro-choice advocates on the abortion issue. Concerns that the court could revisit the abortion issue, perhaps not to overturn Roe versus Wade, but to chip away at abortion rights. If so, what happens then?
Well, I was a proud voter to support HB 40, which has a trigger provision that anticipates the Supreme Court potentially either overturning or adjusting the law of the land with regards to access to reproductive health care. And that provision basically says if there's a change there for the state within the state of Illinois, Roe v. Wade shall continue to be the law of the land. And as Attorney General, I'd make sure that I would enforce that, and I would make sure that providers fully give access to women who are seeking reproductive health care. As a man, it's not my job to tell a woman what to do with her body. It's not my job to restrict her access to health care. And certainly, a woman who goes to a health care provider should be fully informed of all of her options.
As we continue on Sound Ideas, Eric Stock here with Kwame Raoul, who is a candidate for the Illinois Attorney General's office. The state AG's office under Lisa Madigan has contested rollbacks to net neutrality rules, which are aimed to deregulate internet access. Where do you stand on that?
I stand in partnership with the current Attorney General's position. I think, you know, so much of our information, so much of our communication nowadays happens via the internet, and the internet has become quite an equalizer for the common man or woman. And to the extent that there's a change in the net neutrality rules to make it such that the common man and woman doesn't have that same access, I'm going to fight against that.
Governor Rauner has proposed reinstituting the death penalty for mass murderers and those who kill police officers. This 7 years after the state had stopped all capital punishment. You would sponsor legislation abolishing the death penalty. If Rauner's proposal passes and were to become law, what would you do?
Well, first of all, I think just Governor Rauner just put that out there just for strictly political reasons. Our state has taken a step, and I was a proud sponsor of the bill to abolish the death penalty, because we, at the time, were second only to the state of Florida for the number of people we sent to death row for crimes they did not commit. I don't think we need to go backwards on that. You know, there was a gentleman who had spent 17 years on death row for a murder he did not commit. He testified before my committee, and he says you can release a man from prison, but you can't release him from the grave. I think that says it all. As human beings, we run a justice system, and as human beings, we're fallible. And God forbid that we make a mistake, and I wouldn't like to be the person to inject a serum into somebody's body that sucks the life out of them when they did not commit the crime that they were accused of.
Just looking briefly at the Attorney General's race now, you had defeated seven other candidates in the Democratic primary this spring, including someone who had considerable name recognition in former Governor Pat Quinn. What did that campaign teach you as your first statewide campaign to prepare you for this general election race?
That campaigns are challenging, and that, you know, we had an embarrassment of riches in the Democratic primary, and I think it strengthened me to be able to debate against my colleagues, many of whom I call friends today and who are helping me out on my effort to become the next Attorney General. As you said, I was going up against a former governor who had a considerable name recognition advantage. And I just took a message out to the voters. I took a message. I talked about being a father and worrying about my children. I talked about being a former prosecutor. I talked about being a policymaker that worked on a bipartisan basis over the last 14 years. My reputation in Springfield is one of an individual who reaches across the aisle and reaches into other regions. And I planned on continuing to do that as the next Attorney General. Yes, I'm the Democratic nominee, but I have plenty of friends who are Republicans, and I work well with them.
And recent polling that we've seen shows you in the lead in this race with the Republican Erica Harold, but she seems to be leading among seniors, which is a key constituency for an office that focuses so heavily on consumer protections. And also, she's been leading downstate, and that is more her backyard, being from Urbana. How do you strengthen your support in places like McLean County?
To come here just as I've come here today, as I've been here two or three times prior today, and to speak directly to voters as I've been doing today. I think when people are exposed to me and when they hear who I am and who I've been, how I've been active in shaping the policies of the state of Illinois, how I've worked across the aisle. One of the things that was remarkable to me in the primary is the number of folks who approached me after the primary who were Republicans who told me that they drew Democrat primary ballots to vote for me. And I think that's because they listened to the message that I delivered, which was not a partisan message. It's a message that's a message to all of the voters in the state of Illinois.
Kwame Raoul was in Bloomington to campaign for McLean County Clerk Nikita Richards, candidate Nikita Richards. He spoke with GLT's Eric Stock.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, announcing British royalty romance and tomfoolery at this year's summer season. The hilarious Merry Wives of Windsor, heroic Henry V, and witty romantic Shakespeare in Love run July through early August. Tickets at IllinoisShakes.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up on Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet is an examination of how people who've had polio are viewed in society. President Trump visited Illinois last week at a steel mill that reopened in the Metro East. The Illinois Politics Roundtable considers the implications. Moderator Sean Crawford is joined by Kent Redfield, Doug Finke from Gatehouse Media, and IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey, who says it was a Trump victory lap.
It was. From the president's perspective, this really fits in with his message, which is that he wants to come in and sort of break the way we've done things for a couple of decades in this country in terms of foreign trade and what industries we emphasize. And, you know, his campaign slogan was Make America Great Again, and his vision for that is back in, I guess, the 1980s, when there was, you know, manufacturing was already in decline in this country, but you could still make a good living from a union job. You didn't necessarily need to have a college degree or anything like that. You could still raise a family and send your kids to school if you wanted to on a union salary, like being a steel worker. And so there had already been, before he came into office, really, this sort of trade fight about foreign steel being dumped in America in an anti-competitive manner. The United Steelworkers, I talked to the local union president down there about a month or so ago, and he talked about this fight's been going on for a long time. But the president and his commerce secretary made it an emphasis and, you know, finally followed through on this trade case, imposed these tariffs. And right after the president announced these tariffs, U.S. Steel said it was going to restart one of the blast furnaces at its Granite City Works. A few months later, it announced it would restart the other one. Bottom line is about 500 people have been put back to work there at the plant itself. Another 300 are expected to be hired by the end of the year. There are ancillary businesses, companies that, you know, whether it's a trucking firm or potentially even restaurants that, you know, provide lunch to the people who work there, that are also bringing jobs back. This is the long story short, the president was taking a victory lap here.
And Doug, when you think about that, Doug, I mean, Brian mentioned 500 jobs now, maybe another 300, then all those ancillary jobs. We're not talking chump change here. So from a Granite City perspective, you know, I'm not looking at the broader picture of tariffs, but from a Granite City perspective, right in that area, this is something that's probably been a very positive move for them.
Oh, without a doubt. And one of the things, though, that I think you have to keep in mind is there are some skeptics out there who question just how far the tariffs issue played in this, because the plant supplies steel for the oil industry primarily. And when it shut down a couple of years ago, the oil industry was in a slump. It has since made a recovery. And so, yes, tariffs obviously played some role in this, but maybe not the only reason for the plant reopening. And in fact, I saw a news story, and I wish I could remember exactly where I saw it, but made mention that some of the union officials at the plant had argued that it could have opened even before it did, because, again, the market for their steel products had improved, and it could have reopened earlier than it has.
Well, we did see a couple of the compression. Go ahead, Brian.
I was just going to add, there was, I thought it was interesting. You mentioned that these jobs are not chump change, and that's true, they're not. However, I thought it was also interesting that coincidentally, on the day that President Trump was visiting, the state came out with its monthly employment figures for the various regions of Illinois. And the region that is the, they call it, we call it Metro East, but under the state it's classified as St. Louis, the Illinois part of St. Louis. Actually, over 1 year prior, the unemployment rate stayed precisely the same. There was no change in the unemployment rate from 1 year earlier. Now, there were a few, you know, there were more jobs added, but and this is a complicated thing, but, you know, other parts of the state had seen some improvement, some had been worse, and it was about at the statewide average. It was just 0.2 percentage point above the statewide average for unemployment. So it's, you know, it's a lot of jobs, but it's not as though it was, you know, sort of transformative for that region from a, you know, a macroeconomic standpoint.
IPR State House reporter Brian Mackey is part of the Illinois Politics Roundtable, moderated by Sean Crawford. Joining him were Doug Finke from Gatehouse Media and Kent Redfield of the University of Illinois at Springfield. This is GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Luther Oaks, with an established reputation in providing assisted living. Immediate availability with a simple monthly rental program. Moving assistance available by calling 309-557-8000 or visiting lutheroaks.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the enduring appeal of the musical The Secret Garden. Americans might take for granted the Americans with Disabilities Act and efforts to help people live independently, but a man from Chennai, India, visiting Bloomington Normal, says they don't know how much things are different elsewhere. H. Ramakrishnan is a master of a heritage musical vocal percussion technique called konakol. He was in banking, in education, in media. He's given a TED Talk about polio and the millions who suffer still from the virus, even though it has almost been stamped out. H. Ramakrishnan contracted polio at age 1.5. He still walks with crutches. Ramakrishnan says he was immobilized till age 10.
Oh, I wish it had not happened at all. I wish I were not alive during those 8 long years. And my mother used to carry me all through my 10 years, excepting for a small patch between, say, for about a year and a half until I was afflicted by polio. Otherwise, she was carrying me all the time. And when I married, my mother asked me whether I love her more or I love my wife more. I told my mother that I love my wife more. Then she said, normally a mother carries a child for 10 months. I carried you for 10 years. And how dare you say that you love your wife more? I said, she had an option. You had no option.
Mm-hmm. How did you manage to muster the mental strength to go on and to have a career and to become mobile and to be involved in banking and music and media? That's a tall order for anyone, let alone someone who starts with such a physical deficit.
I somehow feel that everyone who has a physical deficit has that mental courage and stamina. But the whole problem is the society around you should encourage him or her to use that mental strength to come up in life.
Do societies do that?
Very seldom.
What was your experience in India?
My experience was, in this sector, it was very bad. Very bad. In fact, but for my family, I would not have come up in my life. Society was merciless on me. In fact, it was cruel on me. Yeah. My own students, they used to make fun of me. They used to call me to play with them, knowing fully well that I cannot do that. But I somehow managed all that and came. I took up a challenge with God. I said, whether it is you or me. And I think God helped me to to succeed.
How can the U.S., how can India, how can any society be changed and brought to be more accepting?
Well, I think from the kindergarten stage, the children should be taught to love the physically disabled and the mentally disabled people. They should be taught from that level, and only then you can see a change. Otherwise, it will continue.
Have things gotten better for you? Does society still have a look at you a little askance because of your physical condition?
I would say the attitude is worse.
Really?
Yes.
How so?
It's worse because I have had even very recent experience of people saying, why not he be at home? If he cannot walk and if he cannot manage these things, let him be at home. This is the attitude of people back in India. I'm very sorry to say this. Not here. In the United States, I feel people are much more, I would say, loving and caring about the disabled.
Why is that difference, do you think?
The difference, I tell you, is in the upbringing. It is in the upbringing. It should start right from the kindergarten school, from standard one. It doesn't happen there.
There are some 6 million in India affected by polio. What can be done for them, and what is being done?
In fact, in one of the Rotary meetings here in Bloomington Normal, I told them that Rotary has been doing very well to prevent polio, but not to those who are afflicted by this disease. So they in fact collected some amount and gave me, which I used to distribute appliances to the physically disabled in my own city, Chennai. But the problem is more in the villages, and especially among the girls who are afflicted by this dreaded disease. They have no education, they have no employment, they have no marriage. Access to the school, that's the main problem there.
And what can the U.S., those interested in helping the differently able, do for India and that climate?
The U.S. can do a lot. The sky is the limit. Because it's a developed nation, and India is a developing nation, and a country like the U.S. can do a lot in helping the suffering lot in my own country.
How goes the war to eradicate the virus itself?
Yes, that is successful thanks to the Rotary International. Yes, now it is almost eradicated in India. I don't think there has been any incidents during the last 4 or 5 years. But already those who are afflicted by polio, they are suffering. They have no job, no education. There are people who are just homebound. They don't know anything outside their homes. These are the problems. They cannot even vocal their agonies. They cannot. I think there should be a very strong urge in the government of the states in India to see that this is eradicated. After Mr. Narendra Modi became the Prime Minister, there has been some positive waves in India in favor of the disabled. But the state governments, the local governments, should play a much more active role to see that there is an inclusive growth in the cities and villages, and the unfortunate victims of polio should not be excluded.
Why is there that cultural stigma? Is it a case of people believing that the outer mirrors the inner, or is there something else going on?
We are a country where people will believe that the outer shell is nothing. It is the soul inside that matters. But unfortunately, there's a kind of a dislike to those who are disabled. It still exists. It's unfortunate. You see, even in families, if there's a disabled child, even the mother says, oh, I don't know what sin I have committed to have a child like you. This is the attitude.
That seems a great shame.
It is a shame, no doubt. That the centuries of, belief in sins and the result of sins. So, supposing my parents had told me that this is because of a sin that you had committed in your previous birth, then there's no other go. I would have to carry with that. And there was no other go. Fortunately, my parents saw to it that the best of medical treatment available at that time was given to me. At that time, unfortunately, there was no polio, anti-polio virus vaccination available at that time, unfortunately.
H. Ramakrishnan contracted polio in the 1940s. He went on to make his mark in banking, media, and music. He's given TED Talks on the impact of polio. Ramakrishnan is from Chennai, India. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. This is Sound Ideas. Prairie Fire Theater puts on the musical Secret Garden next weekend in the Twin Cities. Music director Lev Ivanov, Abby Naden, who plays the young orphan Mary Lennox, and director Kristen Monson are here to talk about it. Kristen, what makes it such a special, ethereal production?
For anybody who read the original novel, The Secret Garden, everyone that I've spoken to recently says, oh, I loved that book when I was growing up. I loved reading it. And more females than males, but some males, too, that read it. It has that gothic Victorian feel of mystery and ghosts and spirits and the beauty of the story of kind of the rebirth of not just a garden, but the rebirth of these very sad people, very ill people that become well, become whole because of this, you know, child that is kind of thrown into their lives who brings that life to them.
Had you read the book, Abby?
Yes, I had. And I read it right before I auditioned, and all I could think was, because Mary can sometimes become a little too bratty, but she is a child, and she's a child who's pretty much lost everything, and she just comes into this new place that she's never seen before, and she knows nobody, and she sort of finds things to hold on to, this garden that she decides to take in and care for. And I think that sort of helps her find her place in this new and terrifying reality.
Lev, let's talk about the music. How does the music fit with this spooky and yet eventually very affirming tale?
Sure. Well, I think it's really wonderful. The music is great. So many wonderful melodies and themes. And we've got these, I don't want to give out too much for those that haven't seen or heard the show, but many people have. So it's got these links between the past and the present. And the music really, complements, the characters that are in the show. There are these kind of a little musical, short musical inserts of, different memories and different things and different events that happen. For example, when we talk about Mary's talking about India, there's this little kind of a bell about India. So it's got these interesting links to to the storyline.
Is the fact that so many flashbacks or so many moments of the magical realism happen in the musical part of it, what does that do for the director and for the actors, giving those non-real moments musical emphasis?
That's a really great question, and we've actually been working on that from the very beginning, knowing when there's a lot of times when spirits from the past are milling about, and we've talked about where is your focus? Can you see everybody that's around you? And how do you interact with the people that are alive if you're not alive? And I think we've found some interesting ways, because those dreamers, those storytellers, they tell the story, so they move the story forward as the musical goes on, and so they're very important. in that storytelling aspect, but it is interesting to find where you fit and how the focus fits, because you see all these people at the beginning of the story as alive and happy and well, and then later in the story you see them shepherding Mary and the others through the rest of the story.
Love is, a lot of musicals have less of an emphasis on the music as moving the story forward. They are set pieces to show a specific moment in time rather than assisting the action. Is that, am I way off base there, or is this something a little unusual in that regard?
Well, I think you're, you know, it's kind of 50-50, you know, because some of the musical are close to something like an opera, you know, and some are, you know, like we all know Gilbert and Sullivan, and that sort of has its own style. You know, this was obviously composed in 1989 and first produced in 91, I believe, on Broadway. Also was composed by a woman composer, which is really wonderful, because, you know, in classical music we have these old white guys from Europe, and I'm really happy that we can celebrate not only wonderful music, but something that is composed by a woman, especially relative, you know, in today's time.
Is it just good music, or is her work somehow different from late 80s, early 90s Broadway composers who are men?
Well, you know, it's interesting to sort of compare those things. I mean, we look at the gender, and we look at, you know, when we look at music, we look at music itself. And it's, of course, you have to judge something on the merit. You know, we always look at the, you know, when I open a score, I don't think about first who was a composer. I look at the music. But it's just wonderful to have that aspect, you know, today, to celebrate women. And celebrate wonderful music as well.
Abby, you're playing Mary Lennox. What is your favorite song, your favorite musical number?
Well, one of my personal favorites that shows Mary really as a character is a song that's at the beginning of the second act, and Mary is singing about, you know, I need a place where I can be who I imagine myself to be.
Where I can whisper what I know, where I can whisper who I like, and where I go to see them. I need a place where I can hide, where no one sees my life inside, where I can make my...
And she says, I need a place where I can hide, where no one sees my life inside. And I just really connect to that, because she's been in this terribly scary situation of, I'm in this strange house in a place I've never been before with people who really don't seem to want me. And just to have a place where you can forget about all that and just be who you imagine yourself to be. And I think that's sort of a comforting sentiment that I've connected to.
I'm just listening to Abby speak, and, you know, when you're casting this show and you're trying to cast a character who's 10 years old, and you think, how am I going to cast an actual 10-year-old to play this part that is going to be able to convey that kind of sentiment? And so I've worked with Abby before, and I knew her. And so when she came in to audition, Abby is very petite, so she looks very youthful, even though she is not 10 years old. I think she's such an intelligent actress that she just does a wonderful job of bringing innocence to this role and that kind of 10-year-old spirit, but she has the maturity to understand what it takes to do a very difficult piece like this.
Happy 16th birthday, by the way, Abby.
Thank you.
There are several really ear-popping duets in the show. Each of you give your favorites, would you?
Well, I think a lot of people know Lily's Eyes I think it's probably one of the most popular songs from the show. So I would say we have two incredible actors, Noel Jones and Blake Miller, who play Archibald and Dr. Craven. And it's just one of those kind of Broadway dramatic ballad duets, and to hear these two men with these really beautiful voices sing it, to me, every time I hear them sing it, I just go, I can't wait for people to hear these voices.
I think of her.
From death she casts her spell. All night we hear her sighs, and now a girl has come who has her eyes. She has her eyes. The girl has Lily's hazel eyes, those eyes that saw him happy long ago. Those eyes that gave him life and hope he'd never known. How can he see the girl and miss those hazel?
She has her eyes. The girl has Lily's hazel eyes. Those eyes that closed and left me all alone. Those eyes.
Love, I think we're really lucky with the cast that we have this year. Just what Kristen said. I agree on the Lily's eyes. It's one of the, you know, one of the highlights of the musical. But I think also there are numbers that are not just duets. Like we have a quartet number with, you know, Rose, Albert, Lily, and I think it's Archie. But it's it's really a powerful number there, where, you know, sort of again, it's the link between the past and the present, between the dead and the present, and it's a really powerful number. I really enjoy that. I mean, it's always hard for me to pick a favorite because I just look at the whole thing.
Happy, what's the favorite not sung by you?
My favorite is probably "How Could I Ever Know," because this is when Archibald is mourning for his wife, and I didn't realize this about until maybe a couple days into rehearsal, but I was looking through the script, and it said something along the lines of, Lily and Archibald embrace their forgiveness complete. And I was like, forgiveness? Why is this forgiveness? And there's this thought of, Lily isn't saying, get over me. She's apologizing for leaving Archibald in such an important time in his life when they have a son to care for.
Without me, oh, when I know you still need me so, how can I say not to dream about me? How could I ever know? How could I ever know?
And she's saying, how could I have ever known that I would have loved you like I do and like I did? And there's just this powerful sentiment of, I know that I'm gone, and I'm sorry. That's not something that I had a choice. And it's just so beautiful, and the music to go along with it just matches perfectly.
It also goes back to the point you were making about these moments between people who are present and people who have already passed, and that duet is between a living person and a memory of someone that he loved, but they get to interact in that song and actually embrace and touch, and it's a little tearjerker. I agree, Abby.
Even the villain of the piece, Dr. Craven, finds some sort of redemption at the end. How does that come to pass?
It comes very quickly at the end. I think he realizes in his attempt to protect his brother, in his attempt in his mind to protect and shelter and shield Colin, the son, and his brother Archibald from society, that he has actually stopped their growth. To use the growing metaphor again.
And his own.
Yes, and his own growth. And in the end, I think he realizes what the impact was of his choices.
Some late 80s, early 90s musicals have not stood the test of time. What makes this one enduring and popular at the community theater level?
I think it's this combination of fantasy and reality, you know, and this, again, it's this link between the past and the present. Because, you know, this garden, you know, it's like a fantasy that we all often think about, the world, the perfect world that we want to build around ourselves, right? But in fact, all the emotions that characters experience in the show, they're all real. Mourning, death, love, hope, you know, all of these, healing, right, is lesson of healing at the end. And I think it makes it kind of special. I always try to look for, you know, emotions in the music and how the music can relate to our everyday lives.
Lev Ivanov is the music director, Kristen Monson the director, and Abby Naden plays Mary Lennox in the Prairie Fire Theater production of The Secret Garden, playing August 2nd through the 5th at Illinois Wesleyan University's Presser Hall. Free tickets are available for children under 12 during Saturday and Sunday matinee performances through a grant from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation. You're listening to Hold On from The Secret Garden. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website, WGLT.org, is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock. It's the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.